Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. We got Dr. Carl, my co-host, and today we got a super guest with us, Dr. Tiffany Moon. She's an anesthesiologist. We haven't had an anesthesiologist on here, have we, yet?
No, and we have a cousin and an aunt who's who are anesthesiologists.
She's But she's right now, she's a superstar on social media. Got like over, 800,000 Instagram. I don't know what your TikTok is. Probably huge. I'm not sure. Do you do YouTubes?
Do you do
the tubes?
Not really. No, okay. I'm like 1.7 on TikTok.
There you go. Look at you.
Yeah, taking and talking a lot then. Holy cow.
She's got a cool story. She's anesthesiologist, currently associate professor at UT Southwestern. Yes. But you went to Cornell, then you went to where for med school?
UT Southwestern.
You went there and then you did your transitional internship year in internal medicine, then did anesthesiology.
At UCSF.
Hmm. Very cool. At UCSF. Nice. And then practiced for a while.
Yeah, I'm in the job that I've – post-residency, I've only had one job ever, okay, which is the job that I currently have.
And you were on the Housewives of Dallas?
Real Housewives of Dallas?
Yes, I was on season 5 of The Real Housewives of Dallas.
How did that come about?
Yeah, how's that?
I don't know not a lot about it.
My wife watches that stuff.
I was going to say, Spencer's wife gets into it, but I don't know a lot about it.
Oh, you'll have to ask her if she's seen Dallas.
We will.
my thought is that most people get on because they have a friend who's on the show.
Yeah.
Like, you kind of need to know someone who's already on or be someone who's well-known. For me, I was not well-known at all. So my good friend Deandra was on the show, and every season when they finish filming, they ask the current cast members, do you have any girlfriends that would be a good fit for the show? We're looking for, you know, XYZ. And she had asked me year after year after year. And I was like, no. I said, I'm a full-time anesthesiologist at an academic hospital. So I'm pulling like 50 to 60 hours a week on average, because I have to take overnight trauma call and liver transplant call, right? And the trauma call is in-house. It's an in-house 3P to 7A shift. And then liver transplant call is home call. But if you get called in, you're gone for like 10 hours, you know? So, and I had twin toddlers. The first time she asked me, I think they were like 3 and we were potty training and I was about to like lose my mind.
So you had a lot of free time is what you're saying.
Yeah. And all this free time and all these hobbies. And Deandra's like, hey, do you want to be on Real Housewives? And I was like, girlfriend, are you smoking crack? Like, no, I don't. And then she asked again, and then she asked again. And then the third time she asked was sort of when I was like in this midlife crisis. I didn't really know who I was. I was trying to figure myself out. I had been working for like 6-7 years post residency. And I was sort of like, oh, like, is this it? You know, like, is this all I'll ever be? Do I just wake up at 6 a.m. and go to the OR every day of my life? Like, and so the third time she asked, I was like, you know what? I'll talk to the producers, but like no promises. Okay. So they put you through these rounds of interviews, basically, where the first one you Zoom, the second one they fly you to LA, the third stage, they have cameras and the executive producer come film inside your house, like you interacting with your family or doing some scene work so they can see how you appear on camera. And those are like the 3 rounds of interviews that you go through when you're being cast for Real Housewives. And then I got a call like a month later and they were like, hey, Tiffany, we want you to be the new Real Housewife of Dallas. And I was like, oh, I didn't really think I would get it. And I forgot about it. So when they told me, I was like, oh, shit, do I want to do this?
That's amazing. Yeah. How old were the kids at this point, the toddler or the twins?
4. They were 4, maybe 5.
Okay.
When we were filming, they were 5.
Wow. Okay. Were you the only doctor that's ever been on that?
To my knowledge, yes. So, you know, the Real Housewives, there's like 10 cities, right? Mm-hmm. Like New York, Beverly Hills, Miami, all these other cities. To my knowledge, I'm the first medical doctor and the first Chinese American.
Oh, interesting. Cool.
Like both separately. And so people were like, oh, you're breaking down barriers. Yeah. I was like, ah, I wasn't really trying to do all that. You know, like it came out in the press and stuff like that. But I didn't go on the show to be the first medical doctor, blah, blah, blah. Like I went on the show because I thought it would be fun and I would make new girlfriends.
Yeah.
It was neither fun nor did I make new girlfriends.
Really? Well, I guess since I haven't seen, now we're going to have to watch this.
We're going to go watch it.
Yeah, we're going to watch it immediately tonight. But I'm really interested in how that, how did that go with your life and your profession? I mean, yeah, that sounds like it's an added stressor. Like, I don't know. I mean, I could see us hamming it up on, you know, at home and stuff, but half the time we'd be walking around naked and then they'd have to cut it and, you know, all sorts of weird stuff would happen and be inappropriate. So how did that play out in real life?
It wasn't that bad just because principal filming is only 12 weeks. And that's actually how they sold me on signing up because I was really hesitant and I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to do it. So the guy was like, Tiffany, you've done a lot of hard things. And I was like, yes, I have. And he's like, it's just 12 weeks. Just sign one season, see how it goes. If you don't like it, don't do it again. And I was like, you know what? You're right. Like, I could do anything for 12 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, we did, you know, residency. I was Q3 call 24 hours, that's, you know, and miserable. I'm like, 12 weeks to hang out with these like drunken, you know, misbehaving middle-aged women, like, psh, yeah. bring it.
You did that in the ER.
Right, right. I just, you know, can't jab them with intramuscular ketamine, but, you know,
intubating.
I wanted to.
So on the show, they kind of hook you up with a circle of friends that's different than your normal life?
Well, I was the only new cast member my season. So like these women all already knew each other.
Wow.
And I was like the fresh sorority recruit, you know,
but so they throw you into it though.
Correct.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That is interesting.
So what, I mean, what's the mandate of like you have to go out and do things with them? How does that work?
You have to film. There are events, there are dramas, there are storylines, and you are expected to fully participate.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, okay. So then afterwards we're kind of like, maybe that wasn't the pathway I wanted to go. And that's kind of, I want to, because this kind of gets you into why you wrote your book.
Yeah.
The joy prescription, right?
Joy prescription.
Yeah, joy which prescription. We desperately need.
Yes.
Because I think we're all.
I prescribe you joy.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to hear the pathway after. So after the show, you're like, okay, that wasn't really what I wanted.
After the show, I was like, I'm supposed to be building a platform that uplifts and empowers women. And I just spent 12 weeks like trying to rip other women down and, you know, being torn down myself.
Oh my God.
You know how some people just like don't bring out the best in you if you've ever had like a, you know, previous relationship or whatever, or you see your friend with someone and that person like brings out the worst in them. That was me on Housewives. And I just didn't like who I was when I was on the show. And then, you know, after the 12 weeks of filming, there's 12 weeks of like a quiet period. And then it starts showing on TV. And oh boy, when it starts showing on TV and you're in everyone's living room, you know, and everyone has a lot of opinions on you and what you're doing and what you're saying.
God.
You have to like relive it. But it's weird because like the thing that's showing on TV that everyone's talking about happened like 6 months ago, you know, and you have to
That's weird.
It. So
crazy.
So I was like, that wasn't necessarily the right platform for me. And I really want to create a culture of like positivity and joy and connection. And so I pivoted myself away from that kind of, you know, culture.
That's awesome.
So what happened? What'd you do?
Yeah.
I decided that I did not have enough laughter in my life. You know, as a child growing up in a strict Asian immigrant household, like laughter was not a priority for my parents. So I wanted to have more laughter and I wanted to bring more laughter to other people. So I tried being a stand-up comedian for a short period of time. I did a few sets.
That's amazing.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool.
That's brave.
No one at Netflix called me for a 1 hour special. So
But still, you know what I mean?
But I put myself out there and I tried it. You know what I mean? To like stand on a stage and deliver like a 15-minute comedy set with just you and a microphone. Like, that's ballsy, I think.
Yeah, it is.
I learned a lot about myself. I have immense respect for comedians out there who are hustling, you know, like doing open mic nights night after night after night until they get discovered. I decided to write the book in late 2021 and started writing in early 2022. It's been a long process.
Yeah.
The journey of writing the book was sort of like going to 10 years of therapy, you know, because you have to talk. I mean, it's a memoir. So I had to like retell the things in my childhood and how I felt about them and really draw the reader in, because it's not like every other thing I've ever written. You know, I've written book chapters. I have like 50 peer-reviewed publications. You know, I've given PowerPoints and stuff like that. But like, this is different. Like, this is about me, right? Like, there's no footnotes. There's no references. There's no slides. Like, it's my life and my story and how I want the reader to like take away a joy prescription at the end of each chapter.
What is a joy prescription? Like, what is that?
I read a little bit, but I want to hear it from you. A joy prescription is basically a actionable takeaway that the reader can get at the end of each chapter so that they can live their lives with more joy. They're actually simple concepts. And to be honest, probably none of them are like earth shattering. You know, one of them is like, stop comparing yourself to other people. And you're like, oh my God, that's revelational, Tiffany. I've never heard that before. No, but how I got to that is I tell you about my story of growing up and how I constantly compared myself to other people and how my parents compared me to their their friends' kids. And it's just this never ending cycle of compare and despair. And so then I arrive at that joy prescription, right? So it's kind of, I would say part memoir, like part self-help.
Yeah.
We've never compared ourselves to anybody else.
Never.
High achieving medical professionals.
Yeah. Never. Not in any of our career paths.
Not in sports. Yeah. Our failures don't keep us up at night. It's all fine. That's fine.
Yeah,
you guys were wrestlers. Yes.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And I was a figure skater.
Oh, okay, there it is.
Like,
so you didn't care about perfection at all.
Yeah.
Perfect. I know. It's like everything. And then I went into anesthesia, which not that other specialties don't care about perfection, but I have a very exacting way that I practice.
Yes. Can't screw
that. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And in many ways, you know, I always say, you know, figure skating is a solo sport. Like, I don't have a team member, right? Like, I'm on the ice by myself. If I trip and fall flat on my face, like, it's on me, right? Yeah. And then in many ways, anesthesia is also a solo sport, even though we're there with surgeons and circulators and nurses and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, if shit hits the fan, like, everyone's looking at me.
Yeah. Yeah. While you're sitting there reading your magazine, while
there are no crossword puzzles, no Sudoku games, and no magazines in my home.
Good.
Does it listen to music?
Because that's a real thing, right?
Isn't that the joke?
It's a joke, but I don't ever do. God, you don't want me in surgery. You don't want me in the OR.
But it must have come from somewhere. I will, you know, this is the honest truth. During certain anesthetics, when the surgery is going stable and not a whole lot is going on, there's definitely what I call autopilot time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People always compare anesthesia to flying a plane, right? Like, when is it most dangerous? Takeoff and landing, right? Mm-hmm. So induction and emergence.
When I put
the patient down and when I wake the patient up, pull out the breathing tube, you know, they have to breathe on their own again, whatever. In the middle, especially if it's a long surgery, like a hysterectomy, and they're like letting the medical student like dick around or whatever, you know, I'm like back here like Jay chilling, you know what I mean? Like, turn up the gas, give a little more fentanyl, make sure the patient's still relaxed, all that kind of stuff. But you have like an hour or two. So if I'm with a resident, that is the time that I will take to do teaching with the medical student or resident, because it's a teaching hospital. I'm an academic institution. And if there's a CRNA in there and they don't really care about teaching, then I'll go do something else and answer emails and work on my research papers. And there's always work to be done.
Yeah.
You're so a high achiever.
I don't know where the crossword thing came from anesthesia, but yeah, that's definitely the
It's probably a guy thing.
Yeah. We're going to ask cousin Stuart. We're going to send him this episode and be Stu. Right. All right. Yeah. What's the truth?
But he's at an academic place, right? Too. I believe our cousin. Yeah. He does it. Our aunt.
Yeah, he just maybe. Awesome. Yeah, I hope he listens to this because I'm going to call him and say that he probably just has the students and the residents doing, and he's sitting there playing Sudoku or something.
So wait, but you're still practicing, is that right?
Yes, I'm still at the same job that I've had coming straight out of residency. I've never worked at any other hospital post residency.
What's that schedule like?
It used to be full-time with overnight in-house trauma call. Oh, and then I decided to join the liver transplant team, which was fun. But also, you know, liver transplants always happen in the middle of the night. They're never like an 8 to 5 a.m. thing. You always start a liver transplant at like 1 a.m. So a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago, I went down to 80%, which is 4 days in the OR per week. And now I'm 60%. So Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, I'm in the operating room, generally speaking. And then Thursdays and Fridays, I get to hang out with cool people like you guys. That's when I did the writing of my book. That's when I would go serve lunch at my kid's school, which is a thing. Oh, I'm like, why I gotta go serve lunch at your school if I'm paying for other people to serve you lunch at your school? My kids are like, no, mom, all the other moms come. Like, you have to come. So then I go and serve lunch at their school on
Friday.
That's
such a classic like trying to do the great mom thing, the great career thing. You're doing it all. I love it.
I am trying to do it all. I think there's a misperception that, you know, you can have it all, you can do it all, this work-life balance. I'm putting balance in quotes. I know you guys can't hear my air quotes. But, you know, I would prefer to use a word like work-life control, work-life integration, whatever word you want to use other than balance, because there's no balance.
Like, that's right.
Some days I'm a good mom. Some days I'm a good doctor. Some days I'm a good author. Like, I just wear different hats all the time. And I think the key is to whatever hat you're wearing at that time, like, not worry about the others. And this is part of my journey too that I describe in Joy Prescriptions. But classically, you're at work. I used to check the cameras because I had baby monitors, and then I'd be like, the babies are crying. Why isn't the nanny picking her up? And then I'd call her. I'd be in between surgeries, you know, checking the cameras at the house. And I'd be like, Chloe's crying. She's been crying for 2 minutes. Where are you? You know, I'm like, I'm going to fire this nanny. Like, you know what I mean? Like, crazy.
Yeah.
And then having the mom guilt. You know, of, you know, I'm in the operating room. Mm-hmm. I miss their ballet recital. I'm not at every, you know, dance rehearsal, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you spend so much time and energy feeling guilty for the stuff that you're not at, but you're not at it anyway. Like, you already missed it. Like, if it's that big of a deal, then put in some boundaries and you won't ever miss any. Like, if that's the priority, to be at every single one of my daughter's dance rehearsals, then that's the priority and everything falls in line. That was not my priority. I said, I'll go to half of them. It'll be fine. You know, I figure skated. My parents never came to anything. So I just, while you're at work, like, forget the mom guilt, like, because it's not serving you. And I have so many women coaching clients that are like, I feel so bad when I do this, or, you know, I want to do this side hustle, or I want to write a book, or I want to start a podcast, but I don't know, like, maybe when the kids are a little older, or maybe when whatever. And it's like, no, girl, like, you just do the thing that you want to do and do it wholly and presently and with all your passion, and then put on a different hat and do the next thing.
I love it. And you actually created something called the Lead Her Summit. That's what my friend, Dr. Danielle, said. Did she meet you there, right?
Yes.
She was like, you need to come. I'm like, I'm pretty sure if I go, they're going to boo me out of there. So, like,
no, we are inclusive. We are aimed at professional women, but we definitely had a few men there.
Get
maybe
this mom out of here.
No, we're inclusive for sure. There was definitely men in the room. I mean, I have a group picture and you can see there's a few Y chromosomes in there.
When is when and where's the next meeting?
It's going to be November in Dallas, November 7th through 9th. We're still working on our speaker lineup, but it's going to be amazing. Is that your birthday, Spencer?
No, it's his.
It's my birthday.
Oh, November 7th. November 7th.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the old balls in this collaboration.
Dallas and stay in a 5-star hotel. All right. Be surrounded by hundreds of beautiful, accomplished women.
That's horrible.
And listen to a bunch of speakers talk about how to level up in your personal and professional life. How else would you possibly want you to spend your birthday?
Docs Who Lift is pending my brother to lead her.
Rachel's going to be very supportive of this stuff.
Are you married, Carl? Yeah. That was my next question. Okay.
Yeah, he's married.
But she's a nurse, and she has added in the new job in addition to her overnight labor and delivery nursing job as running my new clinic. So she's a female professional who needs more joy in her life. I try to encourage her on how to get more joy, and she says those aren't the right ways to do it.
Well, coming to lead her summit, I think would actually bring joy to her. As a good husband, I think if you bought her a ticket to lead her summit and you're like, babe, I'm doing all the things this weekend. You're going to get on a plane. You're going to go like powwow with these other amazing women who are all trying to like, you know, build up their businesses and lives and things like that. And I'll hold the fort down while you're gone. Go have a great time. I would be like,
Send Jenna and Rachel.
Yeah.
My wife's a neonatologist. Yeah. And what you're describing is she's a perfectionist. Yes. She's an amazing doctor, but tries to be super mom, doctor. And it's like, oh man.
Yeah. That's the same with Rachel, my wife. I mean, she's, you know, part of the I think part of what we both saw in them way back was their high levels of not just perfectionism, but they were both in the Navy. So I was in the Navy, Rachel, my wife, and Jenna, his wife, were in the Navy. Spencer was the only one who couldn't cut it. And then, and they were, you know, and yeah, and Rachel's always so squared away. She was always getting pulled by like the highest ranked people to go do other things from where she was. And I think we both really liked that in females. Certainly we have a lot of respect for, you know, high achievers and, you know, and all that stuff. But everything you are describing is, I really am honestly saying they need it.
Yeah. Don't you think, Spencer? That's the whole reason I wrote the freaking book because,
let's get in the book.
Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I was born in China. My parents came to the U.S. on student visas and then got jobs and stayed. I was brought over when I was 6 years old, did not know a word of English, started first grade in the middle of the school year, like got incessantly picked on, called all the names, all the things. Big dork. We moved all the time, like every 1 to 2 years. I ended up going to three elementary schools, 2 middle schools, and 3 high schools. Because my family moved. So it was like we were in the army, but like not as cool. Mm. And I finished high school when I was 15, went to college early, graduated from Cornell when I was 19, went straight into medical school, didn't even take a gap year, like literally was studying for the MCAT while taking like 17 credits. Ugh. And I was like 15 years old. And then graduated from Cornell, went to medical school, graduated when I was 23, did residency, got married, struggled with infertility, got pregnant with twins. And then I was like 30 something. And I was like, holy hell, like what just happened? You know what I mean? Wow. Like I felt like I had just been like, okay, check the box, check the box, check the box.
Yeah,
and
then you did it.
And I was like, oh, okay, I checked all the box. Like, here's my thing. I'm done. Yeah. Where's my prize? And life was like, what prize? Yeah. And I was like, the prize I was going to get when I checked off all the boxes. No. And then I like freaked out, like totally freaked out enough to go on Real Housewives. You know, that was like a pretty big freak out. Because I didn't know who I was and I didn't feel any worth if I didn't continue to like achieve and publish and get awards and make more money and get promoted. And I was just like, this cannot keep going because I'm going to burn out. And like, I just felt so empty inside. So that's when I started working on my joy journey.
This is like hitting home.
Yeah. Do you describe the hedonic treadmill? Is that kind of what you just discussed in the book about how like nothing's ever enough? You feel like you just got to keep going. Then how do you, how do you find, like, and clearly you're not content still, right? Or is you find joy
in the process? Contentment is hard. You know, yeah. I'm not like Buddha. Like, I'm content, you know, I still want for things, you know? But I think now compared to like 5 or 10 years ago, I have way more gratitude in my life. Mm. You know, when you're hustling and stuff and like things are always coming at you, it's like hard to stop and like be grateful. You know what I mean? Like, you mm-hmm. have to stop for a second. And I'm like, oh my God, like think about that 6-year-old little Chinese girl coming to America who didn't know any English, you know, and now I live in this house and I travel and I get to buy whatever I want. Like, that's crazy, you know? So I had to like rein myself back a little because it was like, oh, I can't buy this purse. Like, oh, I want this new watch, but my husband won't buy it for me. You know, I'm like, oh my God, like, who is this person? I don't even recognize her. You know, she's such a pain in the ass. So I had to like rein myself back a little bit. And what I really had to do was cut off a lot of toxic people in my life. Mm. Like the people in my life that made me get into that cycle of comparison. It's like, oh, you just got a new car? Well, I'm going to get one too. I'm like, I actually don't care what car I drive. I really do not. If it could drive me, like that would be the most important part. I just hate driving. I actually don't care what car I'm in. I used to spend hundreds of dollars on Uber every month, even though I own a very nice car.
That's funny.
Because I hate driving. And I didn't have any laughter in my life. Can you imagine? You're like, you know, a full-time academic anesthesiologist raising toddlers. Like, hardly anything is like funny. You know what I mean? Because I'm like at Parkland. It's like trauma and cancer surgery. Mm. People aren't like coming to get their boobs done. You know, like no one wants to see me that day. And then now I think it's like connection. Like, I'm no longer hanging out with housewives or people that like drain my energy. I hang out with my family. I hang out with my dogs. I have like 5 good friends. You know, people are like, oh, you have so many friends. You have like 3 million followers. I'm like, I have 5 friends actually. And that's all you need. Honestly, yeah, I can barely even see them, you know, like my girlfriend and I were texting the other day and she's like, I miss you. Let's grab, you know, wine or tacos and margaritas. And I was like, great. How's April 17th? She's like, bitch, you mean you me like 3 weeks out and I'm your best friend. And I was like, you don't understand. Like, the schedule is stacked, honey.
Yeah,
she's like, no, I get it. I get it. Yeah.
What kind of humor do you like?
I like sarcasm. Oh. I like dark humor. I like puns. I mean, I'll take humor in all its shapes and forms.
Yeah, there's a lot of potty humor.
Oh, I like potty humor. I like elementary humor. I like fart jokes. Anything.
We grew up in a very sarcastic family. Like, we just sarcastic, just mom, dad, mom, Casey,
our grandparents.
And Carl. Yeah, we're very sarcastic. We cope. One of our coping mechanisms is just humor about deprecating humor about our lives.
Especially us. We're always giving each other shit about
deprecating humor. Yes. You know. And if you dish it, you got to be able to take it too.
No.
I feel like you guys have a good
We do. Yeah.
TikTok is a coping mechanism. You know, my coping mechanisms by and large are like trying to make fun of the situation, making a TikTok out of it or something. Like drinking, which is not a healthy coping mechanism, and then sweeping it under the rug, which is what I learned from my Asian parents. Just don't talk about it. Yeah, there's this huge elephant in the room. There's a problem. It's fine. Just sweep it under the rug. Let's never bring it up.
My favorite thing is to bring it up.
That's how you do it with Jenna.
Yeah, but
my thing with Rachel is sweeping it under the rug.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You like to bring it up with Jenna. You and I just self-deprecate and sarcastic each other to laughter.
Yes.
And then everything else is a little mixed bag, I guess.
So okay, so you've found your joy prescriptions, and you feel like, and it sounds like these would probably be relatable to anybody. What type of person would benefit from this? High achievers?
Or, we need it.
Or what type of person?
High achieving people. I think women maybe more than men, but even you guys were saying that some of the things are relatable.
Yeah. So
I think
this is hugely relatable to us. We've talked a lot about our lives. I mean, growing up, we had, you know, everyone's got skeletons in their closets, but we were always, our grandparents, our parents, and we were always talking about high achievements. Mm-hmm. And we were always doing that. Sports, academics. And then if we didn't achieve the best, we're pissed. And we're still pissed. We talk every day about, I was, you know, say, oh yeah, it doesn't keep me up at night. My little foibles of not quite achieving the success in college wrestling bother the hell out of me, despite knowing that it doesn't matter. That yeah, just like trying matter. To teach my 12, 13 year old that it just doesn't matter because I don't want him to feel the same way. And right. yet I can't do it. And Spencer and I, we laugh every day about it because that's our mechanism, but there's a truth underlying it. And we're always, you know, and I don't want to take over, but like one of the great coaches at Michigan State, the football coach several years ago, he always talked about reaching higher. And I loved that, but he was a high achiever and they were always doing well. And I'm like, that's like us. We always need to reach higher in every stage in our life. Just like you were saying, oh, where's my little award for getting to this point? It was always the check boxes. Oh, okay, I did well in college. Now I'm going to do well in medical school. Now I want to be the best in residency. Then I want to be the best in fellowship. Then I want to get the best score in the board exam. Now I want to be the best doctor out there. Now, you know, and Spencer's trying to do business stuff. I try and fail to do the business stuff. Like it's always something. And then even in other sports, like now I want the kids to be the best. I have a hobby of sailing. I want to go win. And it's very, very, very literally just supposed to be a fun hobby.
So, yeah.
So should we take
always feel it?
So should we take drugs or take your joy prescription?
That's what we want to know. No drugs. Not that I'm anti-drugs. I mean prescriptions, not like illegal drugs.
Right, because that's fine.
I think what I want people to know is that the joy has to come from within. And for so long I didn't know that. And I was looking for the joy out here, you know, like grasping at things that were the joy. And at the end of the day, I really had to like deconstruct my life and rebuild it from the inside out. And now I get my joy from talking to cool people, laughing, learning. It's just a different mindset. Like from the outside, it probably doesn't look that much different. You know, like people who have known me for 20 years aren't like, oh my God, she's a completely different person. She like meditates now and stopped cussing every other word. Like, no, I'm still me. It's mm-hmm. just like a switch went off in my head that's like, I cannot continue to chase external validation because it's killing me. And honestly, I got most of the things I was going for and it still didn't fill my cup. So, maybe that's not what fills my cup. And then go looking for, okay, well, then what does fill my cup? Now that's the question, you know? So I tried different things and this is like all the lessons that I've learned that I write in Joy Prescriptions.
I love it.
Did you do, I mean, obviously in medical school, we all do some psychiatry and all that stuff. Did you consult with any like mental health professionals on all this stuff? Because obviously you're bridging the gap for your expertise is in anesthesia. And then a lot of this is obviously psychological, mental health, well-being and stuff. Did you use any of your colleague friends or just use some of the literature or anything like that? Or this is just all of you?
Oh, no. There was lots of help involved. I would say I never sought professional medical help until my kids were like 3. And I think in retrospect that I probably had really bad postpartum depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. I have baseline anxiety anyway. But I didn't seek treatment for it until my kids were like 3 or 4. And the book and the joy journey involved, I would say, 2 key people. One, my psychiatrist and my business coach. So I used to always think that like coaching was something that you had to do, like if you got in trouble or, you know, it was like coaching is punishment. And then I went to a conference where one of the women talked about how executive coaching like changed her life. And I was sort of like, really? So I decided to give it a try. And now I swung the other way and I'm like, everybody needs a coach. You know, I think what happens is as medical doctors, we're very into like, you do this, you check the box, you get this, then you do this, you stay in your lane. And now, because of the work that I've done with my executive coach, like I have a business, I have a summit, I have a coaching program, I'm now an author. Like she allowed my brain to see that I could be something outside of being a doctor, which sounds crazy, but like up until then, I never thought I could. You know, I'm like, oh, I want to have a business, but I possibly couldn't. I didn't go to business school. Mm-hmm. And she's like, so what? You know, I'm like, I don't have any business. Like, I don't know anything. And she's like, so go read, go listen to podcasts. Like, you're a smart girl. Figure it out. And I did, by making lots of mistakes, but also by meeting incredible people who helped me and mentored me. And, you know, and that's how you like learn in life.
Did you feel, because you're kind of talking about your identity a little bit, right? Yeah. And that feeling of what your identity is. Did you feel that way when you were done figure skating? Like, did you struggle with that at all?
Figure skating was painful for me because it was always a fight. It's a very expensive sport and we were very poor. And even when we became not so poor, my parents were still cheap. And so they didn't see the value in figure skating. And it was always that I had to prove myself with skating. And so I'd like be spending hundreds of dollars in private lessons, skates, outfits. And I'd be like, I'm going to show my dad that I can win. And then it'll be worth all this money that he spent on me this month. And then I wouldn't place. And I would go into this like deep, dark spiral of depression. Yeah. And so figure skating is like a bittersweet thing for me. I was never really that good. But I thought that I could have been better, like if I just had more lessons. But I was only allowed to have one private lesson per week, which is like nothing. Like other girls had one private lesson per day. And then in middle school, all the girls at my rink basically started getting homeschooled so that they could skate for like 8 hours a day and do school for like two or three. You know what I'm saying? Like their mom's a teacher. She signs off or whatever. And there was no way in hell my dad was going to let me be homeschooled, right? So that I could skate more to get to the level that I wanted. So I was like, you know what? It's I'm not going to die on this hill. Like, it's fine. And so I just, I told myself, if I don't place at nationals, I won't continue. And I didn't place, so I hung up my skates.
Who got you into it, though, in the first place?
It was an accident because my parents would never, like, encourage me to go do it. There was a birthday party, and the girl had her birthday party at the local ice rink. I went and put on skates, and I was like, oh, this is pretty easy. The other kids were, like, all falling, like, holding onto the side. Like I put on skates and just, like, started skating. Like, I don't know how that happened. It just happened. You know, some kids do cartwheels, and then all of a sudden they're doing a handspring, and you're like, what the hell? You know, like, I just started skating. And one thing led to another. I took some free there was a deal where you can get your first lesson for free. And there's no word in the English dictionary that Asian people love more than free. So we signed up. And the coach was like, ma'am, your daughter's actually really good. Like, you should consider putting her in real lessons. And my mom was like, what? And I was like, please, mommy, please. Like, I'll never ask for anything again. I'll be so good. I'll always get straight A's. Like, please let me have this one thing, mommy. And she was like, okay, but don't tell your dad. I was like, okay, where does he think we go every Saturday? Like, to the grocery store for 4 hours? You know, but that was how things worked in our family.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that story. That's a good story.
Yeah, that's a really good story. I bring it up just because I know we struggle with identity stuff after sports were done in college and things like that. I'm sure I still struggle with all that stuff. So I was just
on a podcast with two other wrestlers, and I was saying I actually took the former NCAA Division I wrestler out of my profile because some people would be like, you're a has-been. Take that out of your profile. I was like, all right, fine. I guess I'm not a wrestler.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
They're like, why do you still have that in your profile? You're a freaking has-been.
You know, there's something about like wrestlers and swimmers and gymnasts and figure skaters. Like I don't quite have my finger on it, but several years ago, I was our director of resident recruitment for our anesthesiology residency program. So I was in charge of looking through ERAS, selecting who we were going to interview, making our rank order list, interviewing every applicant. And every cycle, we went through over 200 interviewees to match our 24 spots. Mm. So I've interviewed a lot of medical students. And I'm telling you, if their CV had something about being like a Division I, like, or they played in college, it was swimmer, wrestler, figure skating, or gymnast. I was like, automatic interview. Yeah. I'm like, this person is going to show up for work. They are not going to tap out. Like, what You're is right. it? You guys tell, what is it about these sports in particular?
They're grueling. Yeah. I think it might be the most, those are grueling sports that you just mentioned it. And the tap out thing that you mentioned, I think that is part of it. And then, I know for us, medical school, I'll be interested to hear what you say, because it's a different situation, but medical school was definitely not easier per se academically, but it felt like a lot of weight off my shoulders.
Relatively.
So it made life easier. Like, I was like, oh, all I got to do is go to school now? This is amazing.
Beat somebody up.
Yeah. And then the problem is then that's where I felt like my identity was lost. I felt like because I don't know. We probably need to talk offline.
Start body.
I had to basically come out of retirement. Like I had to go start working out with the local college team. I did some open tournaments with them because I felt like I wasn't who I was.
And it was very hard. You need a joy prescription.
I do need a joy prescription. I'm telling you, this is amazing to me.
Better by the book.
And we're going to make our wives read it, and we're coming to Texas.
Where are you guys?
We're in Michigan.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Send the wives to Texas in November. Them. The weather's nice. It's not cold.
Yeah. No, I was just there.
I thought I had to go too for the thousands of beautiful women.
Oh, yeah, you
can
come too. Make it a couples trip.
Yeah.
Okay. And then while they're at Lead Her Summit, if y'all don't want to listen to the lectures and stuff, go play golf. We have like really amazing.
We're not good at golf.
We're about like Happy Gilmore before he learned how to putt. But where is Obesity Week this coming year?
I think it's in Georgia this
month. At Obesity Week. Okay, so I used to be, if you look at my CV, most of my publications are about obesity, anesthesia, and bariatric surgery.
Nice.
So I spoke at Obesity Week maybe like 4 or 5 years ago when it was in Las Vegas about-
We were there.
That's where we met McDreamy.
Yeah, we in the airport. We have a picture with Dr. McDreamy from Grey's Anatomy.
I did not get to meet McDreamy. What was he doing at Obesity?
He wasn't at Obesity. He just randomly was from the airport.
We were randomly at the airport all by ourselves walking through a gate of something, and we saw him. So yeah, you tell her the story because I'm the one that made it.
My brother was like, hey, there's McDreamy.
What's his name?
Patrick Dempsey.
I was like,
is it? I go, oh my God, it is. He goes, hey, I'm going to call out. I go, please don't bother him. He's probably.
He was like in this intensive discussion with like some person who must have been like his assistant or something.
Taking like a private jet or something. I'm not really sure what it was. But, and he's like, my brother was like, I'm not missing this opportunity. I was like, please don't. I was putting my head down. What'd you go?
Dr. Shepherd. And he goes, yes.
He goes, Dr. Shepherd. And I was like,
he responds to Dr. Shepherd.
Yes. He looked, he goes, yes.
He goes, yes.
He was the coolest guy. We went over and I said, look, we're at a medical conference. We're doctors. We just wanted to say hi, you know, whatever.
We love you.
And he was like, oh, thanks, guys. And he's like, do you want to get a selfie? I was like, yeah. And then we put it up and he goes, no, hold on, turn this way. And he had us turn for the lighting to be perfect. And it's now one of the best pictures we've ever had. Paling in comparison to how beautiful he is, but we look pretty good too.
Yeah,
because of the lighting.
He was extreme, like, you know, he was really good looking because everybody's like, he's such a good looking guy. It's like, I don't know, maybe it's TV. I'm like, no, he was a very good looking guy. And
he was a good looking dude
in person. Mm-hmm.
Must be nice. I wouldn't know.
His hair. Oh my God, his hair
is perfect.
Amazing. Yeah, I was at a photo shoot on Monday in LA with this famous photographer that's like shot the Hadid sisters and the Kardashians and all these covers of like Vogue and stuff, and somebody walked in and like everybody's heads went, you know, I was like in the makeup chair getting my makeup done, and this girl walked in and like she was just so beautiful, and I was like, who is that? And I couldn't figure it out, and then we were all like looking and stuff, and it ended up being Brandi Roderick. She was like Playboy.
Oh, yeah.
She was on Baywatch.
Yes. Well, I remember.
Like, hey, I don't know. Familiar.
He's like,
is so pretty that it's almost intimidating. Like, you just can't believe that like a human being is like that good looking. You know what I mean? Mm. And I say this as like a straight cis woman, whatever, you know, but I can say that someone is beautiful, a man or a woman.
Yeah.
And she was just so pretty. And then I started talking to her and she's like the nicest person ever. So I don't know. Like I wish that I had the problem of being so
– Yes. All of a sudden, there was something that just popped up that said you weren't being recorded anymore for some reason.
Uh-oh.
So now what does that mean?
Oh, no.
Will it, let's see if this, what do we do? Does it matter? I don't know.
Uh-oh, now we're still probably being recorded hear her, and then they're going to be like, what the heck's going on?
No, I mean, it says she's 99% uploaded.
And it's still turning purple when she talks. Well, maybe that's a sign.
Okay, well, all right. Here's where we're going to put the link to your book, Joy Prescriptions. Everybody go buy it. It's great. We're going to buy it ourselves. We're going to get it for our wives.
Yeah.
I'm going to send it out to my following. I'll put it in my, in fact, I could pre-orders. Should I do pre-orders right now? You want me to do pre-orders? Okay. I'll put the pre-order link in my stories right now.
I'll send it out to my following. I don't want to ask how old you are, but when were you at Cornell?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. She's my age.
I'm 45. So I'm like a Gen Xer. I don't know how to do all this stuff, but I try to keep up with you guys a little bit just to fight misinformation, basically.
That's so good. That's so good. All right. Here's our outro, but make sure you go buy the book. We'll put the link in the bio. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.